Welcome to Catching Up with Comedians. I'm your host, Rich Stein. Back with Tommy Moore for part two. And after telling us on the last show about Pat Cooper and so many other comics that he wove into that, I figured we just lost the great Shecky Green, who was such an icon and a legend, lived at 97, and he just passed recently. I figured who could tell us more about Shecky than Tommy Moore, and he was nice enough to come back for part two with Catching Up with the Comedians. So here we go. But first, Tommy, tell us about, you've written three books. Tell us about that and your credits as well, if you would.
Yeah, okay. Now, I wrote three books on comedy because I've been a comedian for 50 years, and I owned a comedy club, and I had a comedy newspaper column for 11 years, and I probably met every comedian, young or old, during all that time. So I had three books, and you know, I'm not trying to sell books because, you know, what you get in residuals from a sale of a book, you could buy a bottle of ketchup, all right? But, no, I had three books. One was a PhD in happiness from the great comedians, and one is called Joke Telling 101, and the other one is called Comedians Telling Tales Out of School. Mm-hmm. And you can get them on you can get them on Amazon. You can get them on Kindle. You can, you know, you can get them. A lot of stories, a lot of anecdotes. Right. Between the three books, I think I probably covered 150 comedians because I met and interviewed them all, and they were wonderful. Right. Now, you want to talk about Shecky Green? All right, Shecky Green.
Yeah, let's talk about Shecky.
Nicest man in the world. Ooh. The nicest man in the world. I'll tell you the first time I met him. Mm-hmm. First time I met him was Valley Forge Music Fair. And I was still in college and I wanted to be a comedian. And I sent a letter back to his dressing room. Mm-hmm. And it basically said, you know, I'm a young guy. I want to be a comedian. I'm in college. I can't afford to come here every night. But I wanted to see you the first night. And I would really like to meet you. He sends a guy out to find me. And he brings me back into the dressing room, and then he calls the theater manager, and he said, you see this kid? You let this kid in for free every night, and you let him come back to my dressing room. That's the kind of nice, I mean, you can't find a nicer guy than that. I mean, that was amazing. So I went there every night, and you want to talk about an education? When you see the same comedian, seven nights in a row to different audiences, you know, you really learn how to do your craft. You learn how to switch gears. You learn how to move material around. And the thing with Shecky was he was probably the most natural comedian you'd ever want to meet. The man wasn't forcefully on, but he was happily on. Well, I mean, the man would sing backstage. There was a food machine that dispensed soup, you know, a vending machine. And he's in the back singing, why am I in this town acting like a clown? Why am I eating soup from a machine? This is the worst soup I've ever seen. I mean, this was normal for him. Yeah. This was not him being on. This was him always having fun. Yeah. He had a warmth and he had a fun with everything. Mm-hmm. And he was deadly honest. I remember that show. It was seven nights, okay? And for whatever reason, the Thursday night show, very small ticket sales. And so they canceled it and they gave the people tickets to the Friday and Saturday show instead. Well, he came out on a Monday night, the first night, and he said to the people, nobody would do this. He said to the people, I want you to know if you read in the paper tomorrow that I'm sick, I'm not sick. He said, I'm not sick, and that's not why they canceled Thursday's show. He said, they canceled Thursday's show because they didn't do enough promotion. They didn't sell enough tickets. So don't worry about me. Don't send me any get well cards. Now, who would do this? Now, he was the most honest person, you know. I mean, he was incredible. Yeah. He always called me kid. All of them called me kid, you know. But I remember one time, when I was still in college. Yeah. And I had a little part-time day job doing market research. And he had been on The Tonight Show the night before. And he said he was going to be in Warwick, Rhode Island at the theater in the round. Okay. And I just wanted to go see him again. And like, I'm an impulsive guy. About 9:15 in the morning, I went to my boss and said, look, I'm taking the day off. I'll be back tomorrow. And I got on a train and I went to Warwick, Rhode Island. And I went to the theater. I said, what hotel is he staying at? They told me. I called him. I said, look, here's what happened. I just left my job and I came up to see you. He said, all right, go wait in my trailer. And I'll be there soon. Okay. Right. So I go wait in the trailer and security comes and I'm like, no, it's okay. I'm supposed to be here. Shecky said it was okay. And they're looking at me like, I'm a college kid. You know, what are you doing? And he came in and he and his wife were just as nice as could be to me. Right. And they treated me like I was a nephew. That's what he was like. And the weird thing is I went and his manager was with him, George. And he said to George, the kid wants to be a comedian, do something for him. And I went to George and said, let me be honest. I said, I want to be a comedian, but I really don't have an act yet. So, you know, thank you for but I mean, that's what Shecky was like. He was like, he wants to be a comedian, do something for him. I mean, you can't be nicer than that. That's, you know, unbelievable. He was so nice. I mean, the last time I saw him, I had found the first LP that he ever made, which was like in the, I think, late 60s. And I showed him. He said, you have this? Nobody has it. I said, I have it. And he was like, I'll tell you a story about this. He said, I'll tell you a story. He said, when I was like you in college, he said, I went with my date, Shirley Seligson, from the college prom, and I took her in Chicago to see Joey Lewis, the great nightclub comic. And he said, I knew that moment that I had a spark for comedy. He said, I really wanted to be a high school gym coach. But when I saw Joey Lewis, I said, this is something I would like to do. He said, now, fast forward, whatever, 30 years. And he recorded his first comedy LP in Las Vegas. It was called Shecky Green in the Lounge. And the funny thing is, the picture on the cover had him in the ladies' lounge with women looking at him like, what are you doing here?
Hilarious.
Now, he wanted Joey Lewis to do the introduction to the album, you know. And Joey had this guttural voice, which is a whole other story I could tell you. But Joey was like, I want to bring on this kid. He's the new hottest kid in Las Vegas. And they tried recording Joey, and he just couldn't get it right. He couldn't get it right. He tried again and again and again, and he couldn't get it right, okay? Well, finally, they put out the album. Now, instead of using Joey Lewis, Shecky got a friend of his who did a great Joey Lewis impression. And he did the impression. And he brought him on in the album sounding exactly like Joey Lewis. All right? And when the album came out, he played it for Joey. And Joey said, hey, I didn't think I was that good. I did pretty good. And he didn't have the heart to tell him that that wasn't you.
Right.
You know, but he was a wild man in Las Vegas on stage and off. I mean, he was totally open. He did improv to anything, any topic. People would go to see him 5 or 6 times just to see what different he would do tonight. He never did the same thing the same way twice. Never, ever.
And he didn't really like and he didn't like television or movies or all that. He hated waiting around. He didn't have that gene where you could just wait around to tell the director, tell you, go, do your thing.
No, no. He wanted to, plus he didn't want He didn't want to be restricted to like 6 minutes, 8 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He wanted to be able to just fly mm-hmm. and do as long as he wanted. Mm-hmm. And in the old days in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. they liked that because sure. people would come. Shecky Green literally mm-hmm. made Las Vegas. Yeah. I'll tell you how.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why he commanded top salary. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When Vegas wasn't yet Vegas, the Tropicana closed because they weren't doing business.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of Shecky's from Chicago, who was part owner in the Tropicana, said, Shecky, we need you. And he said, okay. And they brought him in, and they said, now, we can't put you in the main room because the main room is dark. It's closed. We didn't get any customers. He said, all right, put me in a lounge. So they put him in a lounge, and he would go wild every night. Mm-hmm. He would go crazy. He would just... And people started talking. And the next thing you know, there was crowds and bigger crowds and bigger crowds. And now they could open the main room because all of a sudden he saved the Tropicana. He saved them from bankruptcy. Now, when all of the other casinos heard that, everybody wanted Shecky Green. Because here's the guy. Because two of the biggest topics Shecky talked about, very much like Joey Lewis, in fact, were booze and the racetrack. And
the two things that killed Shecky and everybody else. But
yeah. I mean, Joey Lewis had great lines. He said, you know, my doctor tells me that I should stop drinking. And he said, I don't believe him because every year I see more old drunks than I see old doctors. Okay. And, you know, and he had, Joey Lewis had the great lines on horses. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, I follow the horses, and the horses I follow the horses. All right? Now, Shecky was in the same vein. He would talk about getting drunk. He would talk about, you know, blowing money. And so he would bring in the people who drank, and he would bring in the people who gambled. Well, all of a sudden, you know, gambling venues were up. Liquor venues were up. Shecky Green was like the comic if you wanted to make money. He actually, you know, did.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you a story. Frank Sinatra saw Shecky Green. He said, I want you to be my opening act when I'm at the Fontainebleau in Miami.
Yeah.
And Shecky said, okay, but, you know, I have a year contract with the casino, and I don't think they'll let me out for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank said, I'll make a phone call. They'll let you out, okay? Because Frank Sinatra could get whatever he wanted, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So he calls Shecky back, and he said, I made the phone call. You could be with me that week, and I'll pay you the same amount that they would have paid you at the casino. Okay. So Shecky does the week. Do you know this story?
Yeah, kind of, but I want to hear it, though.
Shecky does the week, and at the end of the week, Julie comes to him with a check for $3,000 because at the time, Lounge Comic pretty much made $3,000 a week. That was like industry standard, okay? So Shecky looks at $3,000, and he said, what's this? And Julie said, that's your pay for the week. He said, I got to talk to Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And Jilly said, nobody talked. He said, I talked to Frank. And he walks in. And he said, Frank, well, what is this $3,000? You said you were going to pay me what the casino was paying me.
Yeah.
He said, well, that's what the casino pays. He said, the casino don't pay me $3,000. Mm-hmm. The casino pays me $25,000 a week in the lounge.
Yeah.
And Sinatra said, get out of here. He said, Frank, I don't fool around when it comes to money.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I pay my accompanist, which was Herbie Dell.
Right.
I pay him $3,500 a week to be my accompanist.
Yeah.
If I take this $3,000, I'm losing $500 on a week. Frank said, get out of here. He said, look, call the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them what they pay me. And that's all you have to do.
Yeah.
Sinatra called the hotel, $25,000 a week. He said, wow, you're amazing. Nobody makes this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shecky made it because he was worth it.
Right.
He was worth it.
Mm-hmm.
A matter of fact, you know, he was a wild man off stage as well.
Mm-hmm.
He would do things. He would get into trouble. and the police would pick him up, and the hotel would always pay his bail because they wanted him in for the next show. They couldn't take a chance of him not being there. So, I mean, they it didn't matter what he did. They picked up the bail. They said, we need him for the next show. Boom. And pretty soon, he was making as many headlines outside of the casino as he was inside of the casino, which made him even more popular. Let's go see the guy who did this. You know, I mean, he would do things in the casino. One time he told me he was at the crap table and he had run out of money. And he said, all right, wait, I don't have any money, but I'll bet this. And he jumped on the table and he said, I bet my suit. And word of stories like that got out, and everybody in town was talking about Shecky Green. You had to go see Shecky Green. Wow, you gotta, the guy who did this, you got to get. And that's part of how he built his name.
Did he ever tell you the Caesar's Fountain story from his mouth?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh,
that,
yeah.
That's legendary, but I'd like to hear.
One time he drove into the, because he was completely blitzed. He was totally, and he drove into the fountains at Caesar's Palace. And the way he told it on stage was, he opened up the window and the fountains were spraying down on his car. And he said, no spray wax. Well, that didn't actually happen.
Right.
What happened was, you know, he got in trouble for running into the fountains. And later, Buddy Hackett, told him, you ought to tag that story with no spray wax. So Buddy Hackett gave him the line of no spray wax. But I mean, that was just an example of the kind of things that got front page publicity. I mean, and now the other thing, I don't know if you noticed, but the thing that got him off alcohol altogether, I think he was in Reno, he told me, and he was driving drunk. And he veered off the side of a cliff and went 1,800 feet down.
Right.
He said, I was praying all the way. I said, God, please, God, please, God. Please. And he said, the only thing it did, he said, it screwed up my shoulder, but I survived. Yeah. And he said, after that, no more alcohol. Right. No more alcohol. That's it, you know.
And I think it was in the 70s, too. So he had a good 50 years of sobriety, at least. That's what got him to 97.
Yeah.
Wow. 1,800 feet.
Yeah, so, yeah. But he would improvise and say he would. Well, he worked so loose. Like I said, when I saw him 7 nights a week, he never did exactly the same show the same way. And he was very attuned, very, very attuned to the crowd. I'll tell you a quick story. You know how we hear the crowd. I mean, people say there's a term for comedians, comic ears. Now, it goes two ways. Young comedians have the wrong kind of comic ears. If they hear five people laugh, they say, oh, I killed.
Everybody today crushes, you know.
I crush.
This
I
person's crushing over here tonight. This person's crushing there.
Yeah. Now, older comedians know, well, last night that got a bigger laugh than it did tonight, because we're always going for, on a 1 to 10 scale, we're looking for a 10. We're looking for a 10 on every joke. You know. Now, I watched Shecky, and this was in Philadelphia, and he did a show. He did a joke about Mrs. Olson and
the coffee lady.
Okay, the coffee lady.
Yeah.
And all, everything he was doing was getting tens on the volume, okay?
Yeah.
The Mrs. Olson got an 8.
Ooh.
It got an 8, which an 8 is still a damn good laugh.
Sure.
The first thing he said to me in the dressing room was, do they get that Mrs. Olson commercial in Philadelphia? And honestly, I had never seen it.
Wow.
I don't think they were running it in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, I don't think. He said, oh, that's why they didn't laugh as much. Now, just to show you how good he was, He took a commercial that nobody saw.
Exactly.
That nobody could identify.
And still got an eight. Still got an eight.
Still got an eight. He still got an eight.
Yeah. I remember the commercial because the lady would, she'd be stalking you in your own house, right? Wouldn't she? She would walk up in your own house.
Yeah.
Oh, Mrs. Olson with the beans. We got the beans. I've watched a lot of his interviews because I was, going to write his memorial and stuff, but I mostly read them just off the top of my head, but later I went back and watched. Did you ever see that, like, four-parter? It was from, like, 97, where the lady sounds like she's talking to a toilet paper from another room. Nobody, like, Jerry Lewis or Jack Carter would have walked out on her in 2 seconds, and he had to, like, wince to kind of hear what she was. I mean, she wasn't even mic'd for the benefits.
I know.
He sat there for four episodes, and plus she would ask this 25-minute-long question, too, so.
He got strong because when he started, he was doing Miami, he was doing Chicago, he was working a lot of places for the boys, I started out doing those places too. I mean, I would walk out and I knew that half the audience knew where Hoffa was buried and one guy still had the shovel. Okay. So he worked all those places and he just learned to roll with it.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened, you roll with it. He said he worked one place in, I think it was New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been there for about a month. And the owner came to him and he said, tonight, Shecky, you always leave your shoes and your tuxedo in the dressing room to get dressed. He said, tonight, take your tuxedo and your shoes home with you.
We know where this is going.
Shecky said, okay, if you say so. And that night, there was an insurance fire,
That guy was psychic, the fire psychic.
Yeah. He said, one time in Chicago. Oh, and this guy got a tie-in with a Joey Lewis story, all right. But one time in Chicago, he had owed a bookmaker some money. All right. And he's like, I'll pay. And he's walking down the street and the bookmaker's driving the car and the bookmaker says, Shecky, come here. And he said, stick your head in the window. And Shecky can stick it. And the bookmaker rolls the window up to Shecky's neck. And he starts to go and Shecky has to run with the car. That's the way these guys are. And it's funny because a story that he told me about Joey Lewis, all right?
Yeah.
Who, I mean, he loved him.
When he first saw Joey Lewis, he hadn't been slashed yet when he first saw him when he was in college, the earlier story. Joey Lewis was still the original version, right? He hadn't been cut by the mob yet in his vocal cords.
Oh, no. I think by then, he had been cut,
No, but when he first saw him when he was in college,
I think he had been cut,
All right.
So he told me this story. He said Joey Lewis was not an athletic guy. He said, I was an athletic guy. He said, I like to, play. I wanted to be a gym coach.
Right.
He said, but Joey Lewis, if he could take a cab from the bedroom to the bathroom to go take a pee, he would have done that. All right? He said, but Joey Lewis once owed a bookmaker some money.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to work out of town. And he wanted the bookmaker to know that I'm not trying to skip town on you. I'm out of town this weekend. As soon as I get back, I will pay you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All right. So now Joey Lewis gets back from out of town, and he decides to go over to the bookmaker's place. And but for some reason, and I think there was God taking care of him, he decided to walk the five blocks instead of take a cab. Okay? When he showed up, there was a police presence around the building. And he said, what the heck is this? He had just missed the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Oh, my God.
If he had been there, 10 minutes earlier, he would be dead. And he said there were two things he was thankful for. He said, number one, he wasn't dead.
Yeah.
And number two, since they killed everybody, he didn't have to pay off the debt.
Oh, my God. Now, there's a survivor, boy.
Shecky told me that story. You know, so he worked. He worked with all the gangsters in Chicago, like we all did, at least some of the time. And I mean, he partnered with Sammy Shore for a while, and he was just too strong. And you know, two egos, two comic egos.
He said he had some unkind things to say about Sammy, and some of those 1997, and some of those later interviews. He basically admitted. Kind of what Elvis said. Yeah, Sammy wasn't funny. Comedian, he wasn't funny. But, you know.
He could say that. But I disagree. Yeah, I think Sammy, you know, I think Sammy was a very good comedian. You know, what can I say?
Because usually Schick, he didn't, you know, he wasn't one to say it. But I think he, you know, he had a history with him. Of all the people to start, though, together in Milwaukee coming into comedy, it is definitely a rare pairing, you know, Shecky Green and Sammy Shore.
Yeah, Shecky must not have liked Sammy because when I told you I sent that letter back, you know, that letter, I want to be a comedian,
right.
I sent him a 5-page letter. And so when he brought me back into the dressing room, he just said, thank you for the letter, but I want to say one thing. You mentioned Sammy Shore in that letter. I threw that page away.
Yeah, they really.
Yeah,
they really.
So they must have had, must have had. But you know, Shecky. I mean, Shecky. He told me. He said, you know, when I was drinking, I did things.
Sure.
I said things.
Right.
He said sometimes I wake up screaming, saying, "Why did I do that?"
Yeah.
You know, but when you're drinking, I mean, he was outrageous as it was.
Sure.
I mean, he didn't do the do the normal jokes that people did, and that he just went off.
Yeah.
I mean. When everybody was doing normal impressions, you know, like Humphrey Bogart,
Jimmy
Cagney,
you dirty rat, you killed my brother. Everybody did. We were all doing it. We didn't even know who the hell he was. We were like all the guys say on the Gilbert podcast. They were just doing the version of, you know, John Biners or Frank Ocean. Everybody was doing the best impression that they had heard of the guy.
A matter of fact, okay, I'll tell you, bring me back to Shecky Green and the impressions. But I'll tell you an off story because you said they were doing people that didn't even know who they were. All right. You know, everybody, whoever did Cary Grant, did Judy. All right. Cary Grant once said, I never said Judy. Now, where did that come from? I'll tell you where that came from.
Okay.
Larry Storch, who was a great impressionist, was appearing in Hollywood, and all the comics would go and watch him, and they had paper and pencil under the table, and they would steal their favorite jokes, okay? Now, one night, Judy Garland walks in the middle of Larry's act. And, of course, all eyes turn to Judy Garland. So he's got to say something. And as Cary Grant, which he was doing at that portion of his act, he said, Judy, come on down and sit in the front right here. And all the other comics wrote down Judy. And when they did Cary Grant, they did Judy. That's where it came from.
It was a brilliant ad lib, and you're never supposed to repeat your ad libs because they'll never be as funny, but. But it did lend itself well to Judy. It was a good way to get the voice out there like that. But he was.
When Shecky Green did impressions, he didn't do those first. Shecky Green did Maria Ospenskaya from the Werewolf.
Right.
You know, he would do things like, "My son is the werewolf. He turned into a werewolf every night at midnight. I do not care that he is wolf, but we have." Wolf droppings all over the house.
Brilliant.
You know, nobody did that. He would do you Herbert. Nobody did you Herbert.
Yeah. Remember yeah. Lenny Bruce used to do Bela Lugosi. Drink your blood, bite your mama goodnight. You know, so I don't know where he got that from. The brilliance of Lenny Bruce.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll tell you another quick story. Okay. It's funny. He was with, one night I was with him. It was like a 2,000-seat theater. And the manager was like breaking his balls in a funny way because he must have been in there on a percentage deal, you know, as opposed to, because they couldn't afford his fee. There's no way they could have afforded. So he was there on a percentage with 2,000 people in the audience. All right. So the manager decided, you know, tongue in cheek to break his balls a little bit. He said, you know, we didn't completely sell out, so I don't know if we can give you the whole money. And his then Checky's maybe 8-year-old daughter said, I'm going to go out and count how many seats are empty.
Nice.
And the manager said, don't worry about it. We'll pay it whole amount.
That's funny.
So she was a sharp kid.
8 years
old. She was
old.
A sharp kid.
Nice. Yeah. Wow.
But the other thing that Checky had that a lot of comedians didn't have, Checky had a warmth and a likability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, when he was working in Vegas, he said, part of the reason I was different is because I was like a, he said, I was like a Hamish guy. I was like a family guy. I didn't go on stage and attack people. He said, you know, I went off in crazy tangents, but he said, I was always nice to you. I saw him one night. This is true. There was like, must have been 1,500 people there. And there was one guy down front who I guess wasn't laughing. You know, there's always one guy. You know that. You know, and they always sit in the front. You know that, right? And we focus in on him. And after a few jokes, Checky said, you know, I want to tell you something, sir. I've been doing this act for 30 years. And I see you're not laughing. And you know what? You're right. This shit ain't funny. That's how warm and personable he was. He's agreeing with the guy. He's not picking on him. He's not saying, you know, you want to tell your face. No, he was like, he was. I mean, every time I saw Checky only met my father once. And every time he saw me, he said, how's your dad? How's your dad? That's the kind of nice guy he was.
Yeah, he always had the glint in his eye, and he always had like a little smile on his face, you know.
I had never
even considered it till I was writing the memorial, but he did kind of have a resemblance to Lou Costello. He said that. He said that himself. Because he was, you know, the old saying, he was 5'7 tall and 5'7 wide. I think you can see in some of the older Carsons, he was like a lot of guys. He was heavy and middle aged, but a lot of that's from the drinking and stuff. But as he got older, he got, you know, kind of thinner. You know, he wasn't corpulent like he was in his heyday. But the booze did that, and when he was boozing, I'm sure he wasn't eating the best.
Right. Yeah. But he took care of himself at the end, you know.
That's for sure.
And I mean, 97. That's a good run.
Man.
That's a good run.
Somehow,
you know,
they had his.
And he,
go ahead.
No, they said when he lived in Palm Springs, when he lived in Las Vegas, he would go. He would be funny in the grocery store.
Sure.
He would make people laugh in the grocery. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't forcefully on.
Right. He wasn't.
You know how there are some guys.
Like, they're never off.
No, he was just friendly on. You know. He was incredibly friendly, and that's part of the reason why people loved him. Because they could sense the warmth and the friendliness of him.
Right.
You
know that Ronald L. Smith book? You've probably read a lot of his stuff. It's that
big, thick
book. It's the Who's Who and Comedian. And they had his date. They had his age wrong in that book. They had his age one. So in my mind, I was thinking he was like gonna. I was hoping he's gonna make it 100. So I thought he was. By the age, he was going to be 99, but when he died, he was a little shy of 98, but he was, so So I go, man, Ronald L. Smith had the, you know, birth, date of birth wrong. So then I went to IMDb and all that stuff. But that's, you know. But yeah, still, like you said, when my father passed away at 88, and my cousin, my first cousin on his side, said, I'll take that deal right now. I'll take 88 right now.
Yep. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Well,
Go ahead. No, I mean, given what he put his body through with the alcohol and the fact that he made the 97 is amazing.
Oh, yeah, because when that head was in the window of the car, it could have all ended right there or down the ravine in Reno. Did he ever, I know we heard the fountain story, but did he ever give you his version of the, because it was the goons, right? It was the goons of Frank that it was a great line, he's had enough, but did he ever give you a little bit of that version of the story?
Well, yeah, his version was basically, at one point, this was when he was in Miami working as Frank's opening act.
Yeah.
You know, Frank said, stick with me and I'm going to make you a star.
Now, how long had Shecky had been working in the Vegas lounges for a couple of years by that time? Or?
A lot of it. Yeah. He was already a star in Las Vegas. He was making more money in Las Vegas than anybody.
And isn't it true, before he even got to Vegas, he did Milwaukee, he did New Orleans, when he went to Vegas and then he started in Reno, he'd probably already been working as a comedian before he hit the first lounge in Vegas. 15?
Oh yeah. I mean,
years maybe.
when he was in Florida, Barbara Streisand was his opening act. When he had his own club, I think it was the Wits End in New Orleans, Al Hurt was his musical director.
And then remember his story when Elvis first came and he was supposed to open for Elvis. Elvis was so weak that they had to open with Elvis and he had to close, right? It was at the International.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you the story the way he told it to me.
Okay.
He said, you know, Elvis was brought in because the Colonel had clout. Mm-hmm. And Elvis was big with the teenagers, and he had the hottest record, and he had blue suede shoes, and he had, you know, Hound Dog. And so the Colonel sold him a bill of goods. Elvis is going to be big, all right? So, and they had Shecky open because... nobody really knew Elvis of the older people. And that's who went to Las Vegas at the time. You know, teenagers didn't go to Las Vegas, all right? So they said, we'll have Shecky Green open because at least the Vegas people know Shecky Green and they'll come.
Sure.
All right? And he said, you know, my people, the Shecky people came, and the Colonel was outside with a rifle telling other people to come in to see Elvis because they didn't really want to come. He said,
The old carny never got out of him.
never. So he said, the first night, he said, you know, I did what I did, and the people loved it. And then Elvis came out, and they were lukewarm. You know, they were like, okay, he's got the hit records, okay, but he's no Shecky Green. So they immediately switched the order, and Elvis became the opening act. Shecky was closing act. Now, when Elvis was on, okay, first of all, he would come out in a red satin baseball jacket, okay? And Shecky went over to the Colonel, and he said, listen, can I give you a tip? That's not classy enough for these rooms. He's got to learn how to dress. Yeah. They took him to Liberace.
Oh, boy.
And Liberace showed him how to dress. And that's why he always, from then on, would dress very flashy, very flamboyant, very show businessy.
Right.
And he said, Shecky said, you know, it's funny. The last time I saw Shecky, Bobby Vinton was his opening act. And Bobby Vinton's big song was Blue Velvet.
Right.
And Bobby Vinton would come out in a blue velvet suit. And he said, this is the second act I had that came out in a blue velvet suit. You and Elvis. He said, Elvis sang Blue Suede Shoes, and he had a blue velvet suit. And now you got a blue velvet suit. All right. So now he's with this. Now I'm going back. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to, you know, Elvis being the opening act. And Shecky's sitting in the casino with Bing Crosby. And Shecky's like, I don't know. I mean, the kid is a very nice kid and he can sing, but I don't know. Bing Crosby said, I'm looking at him. He's going to be the biggest thing in show business.
Wow.
And Shecky said, really? And Bing said, yeah, because he's different.
Wow.
And Bing Crosby, of all people to appreciate Elvis, Bing Crosby saw that being different, he was going to be big. You know, and that and that's exactly why Shecky was big, because he was different. He was, I mean, everybody else was doing "Take My Wife, Please," and Shecky was coming out doing, a 20-minute version of "Madame Butterfly."
Yeah,
you know,
giving the audience,
I mean,
what they'd never seen before and never expected.
Never seen. Who would expect to see an opera from a comedian?
And all the acts from Vegas started going to see him, right? All the other comics and singers.
Oh,
it's like, here's somebody who's not doing "Take My Wife, Please," and "Ladies and Germs." Wow, that's what made him a legend and made him. So when he, I had thought that he had. I think he did move to Palm Springs probably sometime in the 2000s, but then he ended up moving back to Vegas. Is that where he?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
where he was living when he passed.
I believe so. Yeah, he, you know, his wife wanted Palm Springs, so he stayed with Palm Springs for a while. You know, but he didn't like it. It was not, you know.
It was kind of dead.
But he was not just. He was just so nice.
Mm-hmm.
He was just so friendly and warm and nice.
Right.
And that's what I'll remember him. Beyond the talent, beyond the improvisation, beyond the insanity, you know, he was just so nice.
Wow. Well, if you have any more, I'm just gonna make you the co-host of this. I wish I could talk to Tommy more. You've got a great. You've got every week. Every podcast should be with Tommy Moore. You yourself are one of those guys who's really a legend in the business, and anybody who's been in, you know, I always say that I did comedy for about 15, 20 years, pretty hard on the road, you know, and going all over the place. But I always say comedians don't usually, you know, quit or retire. And I always tell people, it's like what Lenny Bruce used to say, if you're going with a girl for 7, you got to kick for 2. You know, he goes, I think I left a brush over here or a comb or something. Cause I would never, I was teaching, but I still had Jackie Vegas and friends that I was working locally. So I, from the time I started teaching, I still did comedy for about 7 years. And then I started comedy again. Then I started comedy again in 2013. But as Rodney used to say, but nobody noticed. You know.
There you go.
So, but I'm still, I'm kind of enjoying doing this kind of stuff. And really pleasure. And I have to say, I was a little nervous because you're, you know, in my circles and then the circles I ran, you're one of those guys who's a legend. You're maybe a little too humble to admit it, but what a career
you've had.
You've had a great career and a great life.
But thank God, I really did it the way I wanted to do it. I never did the road.
Right.
I was a Philadelphia, New Jersey, Poconos guy, and thank God I made a living for 50 years doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't complain. Mm-hmm. It was fun. Mm-hmm. Every minute was fun. Mm-hmm. Every minute was fun.
That's great. Yeah, I love your...
So thank you for having me on.
Tommy
Moore.
It's
always a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about. And you know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, sometimes I do these podcasts, and, you know, they're with somebody who's been a comedian for a minute and a half, and they really... and you can sense right up front that they don't know the questions they ask. So I have learned to just go on and on and talk forever.
Like Rodney used to do on his Carson spots. Or
that's right. Like that. You know.
But I mean, I tend to kind of, I'm a little bit of an interrupter and stuff, but I knew.
That's good.
I knew
no,
with you,
but you
though,
know
to
what,
lay back.
You know what you're talking about. Yeah. You know what you're talking about. So I'm glad you interrupt because I know it's going to be a worthwhile interruption. Mm-hmm. It'll make me think of something else that, you know, that I wouldn't have thought of.
Well, you've like, read my you've many... read my memorials that I write, and you
yeah.
thought they're
oh,
pretty...
they're excellent. Yeah. They're excellent. Yeah.
Well, I try, and I really write them for the most part because you're, I think, like me. I've got it's all in there, and I start writing it because you've written 3 books and you've written a million your newspaper articles and your comedy stuff, and you know, when you start writing, it just all happens. You know, it starts coming out. Somebody used to say that you, there's something mad, because I write a lot of stuff now on my phone. You know, I just start writing it on my phone, because that way I can email it to myself, and I've got it, because in the old days, I wrote a lot of stuff longhand, but then you got to write it again when you write it longhand, so you're kind of beating yourself up, but I start writing it, and it all comes back. But I've listened to a lot of podcasts, and I'm a student of comedy in addition to being a comedian myself. I've always loved, like I heard John Biner on the Gilbert podcast, and he said he was at the Sullivan show the night Jackie Mason purportedly flipped off Ed, which we all know he never would have done that. And he was just pointing his finger. I got a finger for you over here. Got 2 fingers over here for this guy. So, but he was here, and so he heard Ed Sullivan. He was right outside the door, and Ed Sullivan was calling him all kinds of derogatory names and swearing and screaming at the top of his lungs.
Yeah.
Did you ever, were you able to ever swing by the Sullivan show just when it was still on? I know you would have been probably just in high school still then.
I was probably in college, but I never got to see the Sullivan show. I mean, I went to the Ed Sullivan Theater to see David Letterman, but that was it, yeah. But I mean, the Sullivan show was show business. There was everything. Mm. It was that's the thing. We're off topic here, but I think part of the reason why we were entertainers is if we watched Ed Sullivan and we saw comedians and jugglers and singers and dancers and elephant acts and whatever, and we saw different kinds of comedians.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
We saw, one-liner comics. Mm-hmm. We saw dialecticians. Mm-hmm. We saw visual comics. And we got a little bit of all of that in us. Whereas I think the comedians that are coming out this week, haven't seen anything but just dry monologists. So they're being dry monologists. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing one comedian, you go to a comedy club and it's one after another, and they all kind of look the same, and they all kind of sound the same, because they didn't have our background. They didn't have our. Mm-hmm. They didn't see the panorama that we saw. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great line. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, Grover Silcox, great Philadelphia comedian.
I've seen the name.
Great Philadelphia comedian. He said a young comic, and this was his line. Mm-hmm. But he said these young comics don't know. You know, they don't know what we went through. They don't know. He said I had a comic come up to me and say, "You've been in this a long time. Mm. What was it like before last Thursday?" I mean, it's not their fault. Mm-hmm. In a way, it is their fault because they have YouTube now. Yeah. They have YouTube. If they want to, they can see Pat Cooper. Mm-hmm. They can see Shecky Green. Mm-hmm. They can see Jackie Mason. Mm-hmm. They can see all of these guys, but a lot of them just don't delve into that. That's why I enjoy talking to you, because you brought up, nobody brings up Jackie Gale anymore.
Yeah. I love him.
But you did, because you know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know what you're talking about.
I came across that. No, go ahead, Jackie Gale.
No, go.
Well, I when I wrote his thing, I wrote up a thing on him. It wasn't one of my long ones, but I was in my files in my garage. And I'm a pack rat. I save every piece of paper that I ever got. My friend Dick Body, the 85-year-old guy with a bad phone, he goes, not only do you save them, but you make 10 Xeroxes, which is true. Yeah. So I was in my files in my garage, and I opened up a book, an old Vegas book, and the Jackie Gale obituary flew out of it. And it was, when I used to work as a teacher, we had these, you know, $50,000 Xerox machines that had a remove background component. Remove background. You could take an old yellowed newspaper, and it would make, it would take out the yellow, and you, there was a gradation to it. You could lighten it up. Wow. So it would remove all that old. So a lot of my old copies were from the school Xerox machine, but I saw it, and it was a great little write-up because it talked, I think it talked a little bit about Lenny Bruce's mom, you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it was a good little short one. But it talked about how, you know, Tin Man really helped him out a lot, and the roast. He did two things toward the end. He did Tin Man, and he did another pretty high-profile movie. He said when Tin Man clicked, he goes, well, I finally made something that will go for all time. And I was trying to watch it the other night, but it's not on streaming right now, but I'll get it. Did you say you have a quick Jackie Gale?
I'll give you a Jackie Gale line. Okay. I'll give you Jackie. When Jackie was working in the Atlantis in Atlantic City, there was a strike among all of the housekeeping staff. Jackie walked on. He said, you know, I know there's a strike. If any of you were staying in the hotel, just try to be patient. Housekeepers will get to you when they can, because a lot of them are on strike. He said, today I called down housekeeping. I said, could you send up more toilet paper? And they told me to eat less.
All right. Once again, what a fantastic show. Not only do we've got Shecky on this one, but we got some Jackie Gale and some Jackie Mason and so much stuff you bring to the table. This was a great one. I think we topped an hour on this one, Tommy. Thank you so much.
And it was fun. And you know what? If I could say one more thing about what Shecky Green taught me.
Absolutely.
He taught me this. He said, every night is its own entity. You walk out on that stage, the audience doesn't care that you got a standing ovation last night. They don't know if you're going to bomb tomorrow night. All they care about is tonight.
Right.
So you go out there and you give it your all, and you have fun, and the audience will have fun with you.
Amen. Because in this industry, there's a lot of people that put on a nice front, but they're not so nice.
Now, I spent hours and hours with him in a dressing room, and he was always nice and always congenial and always friendly and happy and a joy to be with.
Amen. That is so great. Thanks again. This was a great one, Tommy, and I'm real proud to know you and to have you on my show. Oh, Tommy, it's been an absolute pleasure, and you brought so much more to it today than I'd ever even heard about before. So I want to thank you so very much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, Tommy. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.